Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday. And I have no idea what day it is. What day is it, John?
The 9th? The 9th.
Thank you. The 9th of March. John Gerda is our guest today, and John has written, you know, what for him is he's a historian, and he wrote a real pointed article in Sunday's Crossroads section in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, which I thought was very, very good, and we wanted to have him on. He's been receiving a lot of response to this. The title is Smashing Demon Government, and he writes about the current brand of conservatism, which is playing out right now in the state of Wisconsin, being the philosophical first cousin of prohibitionism. He goes on to talk about teachers and about what's going on in Wisconsin right now, and we're happy to speak with him about this. John is a Milwaukee-born writer and historian. He's been writing about Milwaukee for a long time. He's written 19 books, and I'm sure that many of you are familiar with The Making of Milwaukee, which was done also, it was a documentary on television, very well done. He also is a lecturer. He's a tour guide. We'll have to sign him up for a tour of some kind. A local history columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He is also an 8-time winner of the Wisconsin Historical Society's Award of Merit. We'll be welcoming phone calls. We've been on related issues for a long time now, so I know our phone lines will get busy. Here's the number for you to call, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. Hello, John. Thank you so much for being with us.
Nice to be back, Kathleen.
What's happening in this state obviously stirred a lot in you because you are a historian. You do have a point of view in this article, and you obviously feel fairly strongly about what's going on. Are you getting a lot of that kind of response? John, you've written something that's quite pointed.
Yeah, I got a response a couple of days ago saying, you know, pretty much I shouldn't have opinions, but the response has been a little overwhelming. The column obviously struck a nerve, which is not real hard to do these days. Mm-hmm. You know, and passions are so inflamed. My wife amuses herself by keeping track of the response. I think it's up to 2,400 thumbs up on Facebook.
And are you serious?
About 250 follows in the Journal Online site. So it's been fairly kind of an avalanche. And much of it's constructive, much of it's positive. Some tends to be on the vicious side, but that's kind of what you expect.
Right. You're the first one who I've heard say that what we're seeing playing out in Wisconsin is the philosophical first cousin of prohibitionism. You make the comparison because?
I was lying in bed early, and I think this is causing a lot of us to lose at least a little sleep. I think it was early, and just when this began to play out, I think it was after the budget repair bill, was first introduced or first floated in the media, at least. I was trying to, what's behind this? You know, what is the motivation? Kind of what's driving this? And certainly in Walker's case, as in all public officials, ambition is certainly part of it. But there's something more, and I certainly respect the motivation of anyone who has deeply held principles. But in this case, what I began to think was that there has to be one thing that they're kind of after. And read some of the Tea Party blogs. And the target is it's big government, especially big government taxes and deficits. And it tends to be something of a single issue kind of a focus. And I began to think, where else have there been single issues? And prohibition is fairly obvious. So if you do the parallel, demon rum. It was kind of an early predecessor of demon government, and that certainly is a demonization going on of government itself as well as public employees. And also the sense that there is some kind of a silver bullet that if we can knock out alcohol, things will be just fine. If we can reduce the deficit and balance our books, things will be just fine. So it tends to be kind of a rather one-point answer to some very complicated questions. So that's where it kind of came from. And also the whole kind of the crusading zeal, with which the Tea Party operates. And that has certainly some very obvious throwbacks to prohibition. Demographic base, a lot of Protestant evangelicals, are on board. Certainly Scott Walker's demographic. So there are some strong parallels. political strategy. You know, the dry lobby would use whatever it could, including World War One, you know, to kind of, at a time when people were casting aspersions on anything German, they made sure that included beer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they really kind of drove that wedge in to the point where they convinced even people who drank that going dry was a good idea. And I think what's playing out now is that we are in, obviously, economic turmoil. The recession has not worked its way out, but this has been being used as something of a pretext or a Trojan horse, you know, to kind of move the agenda forward to limit government on all fronts.
One of the things that is particularly troublesome to me, and you can see it in the number of teachers who are in Madison these days and who are very concerned, and school districts who are very concerned about massive cuts to education. I just can't imagine, should this all play out the way the current administration would like for it to, what's going to happen to schools in this city, the move toward more voucher schools, privatization of schools, teachers not being able to negotiate. Who's going to, A, want to be a teacher, and B, why this really singling out? They've taken on a whole lot. But why make people who teach our children as upset as everybody is who's in the teaching profession?
I'll tell you a scary story. A good friend who teaches in Menominee Falls and has for about 30 years. No, so she is a veteran. I mean, she knows what's going on in the classroom. She is now advising the younger people on her staff to go back to school, get different degrees,
really?
And leave the field.
Really?
You know, so is that the kind of change, you know, that we elected Scott Walker to accomplish? No, it's frightening. And I think what's going on, it's not just the body blow to MPS. This affects, you know, Medford, Superior, you know, Gills Rock, Cornucopia. You know, it's all around the entire state. And if you first of all reduce state aids and then lower the cap on what a government can tax to make up some of that shortfall, you know, you are doing nothing but requiring a net reduction in education. So I think what's going on is we are devouring our young, which I find frightening in the extreme.
And what would be the reason for that, John?
Boy, if again, you'll try to put yourself in the shoes of you know, people on that side. And I think it's a sense that public employees have had a free ride in the gravy train for far too long, and it's time to bring them to heel. I would hope that people realize that even though they might think of these well-fed public employees, that's also, you know, Mrs. Mintner and Miss Johnson and Mr. Clay. So it's the people who are teaching our kids.
Mr. Staley, all the people who
you remember who
made you who you are.
I know. Yep.
Yeah. You write a lot of things. Why on earth would you declare that police officers and firefighters are more important unless your aim is to divide and conquer?
Right. I think that's obviously true, you know, in Milwaukee's case, as the mayor has so often said, it's about 80% of the budget. And they backed him in the last election. Teachers did not. So it's hard not to see some payback going on there. But I think the scarier feature is that you have, you know, people who are pretty much in one public sector, but you drive a wedge between them, you know, trying again to divide and conquer, you know, split and rule. So it's the word cynical may not be inappropriate, you know, for describing, you know, that kind of a strategy. I think it's been heartening that among the demonstrators in Madison have been a lot of people in uniform, you know, firefighters and police.
I was watching Naomi Klein was on television last night, and she has written this. She's smart, I think, but she has said that she's it's starting to see, and it's amazing how much national attention this story is getting, a turning point taking place here. And she said, when people do fight, they sometimes win. Mm. Do you think that those teachers and firefighters are winning, whatever that means? And I don't know what it means exactly.
I do not know how this is going to play out. There are certainly, there's some intractability, certainly on Walker's side. No, he is nothing if not dogmatic. I know he's showing some movement, you know, into today's paper, but, you know, not retreating from his basic position. And I think one possible outcome here is that from the public employee side, the battle may be lost, but the war is just joined. And I think people who did not vote last November will be out in droves in the next election.
Do you?
Because you have to remember that he won by 52% of the vote, and that does not constitute the keys to the kingdom.
Mm-hmm. And why was it a Republican sweep, John? It is unusual, isn't it, for the state of Wisconsin?
Oh, absolutely. We've always been, or we have been for many years, you know, kind of a purple state, you know, which is not that we're all moderate, but we have, you know, people arrayed on both sides. I think what happened is you have a tough economy that was not getting better. You have stubborn joblessness. And under the Democrats, things were not moving that fast. So what do? You change the channel. And this was not so much, by any means, an endorsement of the Republican position, and certainly not the Tea Party position, as much as it was kind of a repudiation or at least a desire to do something different from what the Democrats, you know, had been offering. So it wasn't that they were the party that was going to lead us all to the light. They were the other guys, is what it amounted to. And I think, not surprisingly, we all do this. You know, kind of hear what you want to hear. People like Scott Walker and Paul Ryan have heard this as kind of a clarion call to arms. You know, the people are behind them, and they can kind of march forward with confidence. That has proved not to be the case.
You know, really proved not to be the case.
The polls, you know, kind of show a steady decline in job approval. And in the morning paper, you saw just he is now the most polarizing governor in the entire country, and perhaps in Wisconsin's history. You know, you have to look back over that. But someone who, I'm reminded, you know, in Madison, seeing all those signs, in some ways we're kind of returning to the mood of the 60s. Remember that old Steve Stills song?
I remember those days, yes.
The battle lines being drawn. You know, nobody's right if everybody's wrong.
So. Do you think that he's surprised at all by any of this, or did he think that this was going to go down just fine?
I don't think he expected to go down just fine. I think he is enough of a true believer that it doesn't matter. No, this is not a person I would consider a calculating politician. No, who's driven by the polls. No, he is someone who is so certain that he is right that there really is no felt need to compromise or bargain.
Unless he gets some pressure, perhaps, from Republicans who are in districts where they may be recalled.
You would hope so. You would hope so.
You also talk about this, and the consequences of this are overwhelming, because I do think it's true that many of us move to Wisconsin or stay in Wisconsin, in your case, for all these years because of what we are, that our schools have been very good. Milwaukee's had great parks. I always tout how wonderful they are. You write here that what is happening here, that we need to think about it, crumbling roads. We're all driving through streets that have potholes. Yeah. I'm thinking of it this morning as the weather is so crummy. Who's ever going to pay for those? I mean, how is the city of Milwaukee going to have any money for that? The schools aren't going to be very good. What rational employer would invest in a state that shows such willful disregard for its own welfare? If you want quality of life, come to Wisconsin. If you want to live on the cheap, go to Mississippi.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's been kind of alluded to before. Are we kind of in a race to the bottom? And is the competition going to be the Deep South? You know, you certainly, absolutely hope not, because that is so contrary to the Wisconsin tradition. No, we have always been a people who believed in a high quality of life. And that's certainly true of Milwaukee. It's true of the state as a whole. If you look at the whole notion of common wealth, no, that's something that I think has been a very robust part of the expectation of Wisconsin citizens. And if you have this relentless concentration on cutting and cutting and cutting, we are at the bone. No, we are into the bone. This is no longer trimming fat. You know, at some point, the body begins to disintegrate. I've been on the library board here in Milwaukee for the last 15 years. 2 years ago, we cut hours by 22% across the board. And we added a few back on this last year, and we were very close to closing libraries. And in the current budget, you know, how can we possibly, you know, maintain status quo? And these are things that that we use, you know, by the hundreds of thousands we use. So the analogy I use, Kathleen, is to a patient who already has anemia. And if you cut taxes, as Walker already has, by, what, $140 million, it's kind of like bloodletting. And in the last budget, as I said in the article, he said things have gotten so bad that we need to amputate. You know, so I think the obvious tack and one of the more insidious effects of the dialogue in the last several years has been that even a modest increase in taxes has been just pilloried as something that would bring the sky down on our heads. In Walker's case, a couple of years ago, we had a referendum that by a majority, a slim majority, but a majority, you know, approved asking for a sales tax increase to support parks and transit. And Walker basically said, we can't afford it. So it's kind of father knows best. You know, and if you have that kind of mentality, there will be no way forward. Obviously, if you have all this bleeding, you stop it and you give the patient a transfusion.
So is that the answer? Because he does say repeatedly, and a lot of people believe this, of course, not only in Wisconsin, that we are broke. He has said this over and over. We are broke. We are broke. We have to do this. We have no choice but to do this. What are the alternatives? A sales tax?
Sales tax, raising the income tax. You know, there have been a variety of tools. The least objectionable in surveys certainly has been the sales tax. But if you look at the numbers, you know, we begin to get into the realm of doublespeak here, you know, in the statements of our public officials. But Wisconsin ranks 37th out of 50 in our public debt per capita. So we are in the close to the bottom quartile in terms of our debt load, which is not saying we're in great position, but compared to most of the other states in the country, we're doing just fine. We still have a AA2 credit rating, you know, which is doing pretty well. So this has not been a catastrophic fallout. We are still in relatively speaking, we're still in good financial shape. So again, using the issue of the deficit as kind of an entering wedge, you know, for furthering a small government agenda, I think is what's going on here.
And as you think about it, it's probably going to be the subject of a next column or maybe a couple of weeks down the road. But when you look at other polarizing figures in Wisconsin history, governors, certainly McCarthy comes to mind. Has this been a state where there have been a lot of polarizing figures or not?
No, I think for many years, you mentioned McCarthy is certainly one example. A lot of people locally didn't take him that seriously, including Frank Zeidler. He became more a kind of a national figure and he got to have his own entry in the dictionary to I'm certain the chagrin of his descendants. But overall, no, there has been a pattern of moderation on both sides. No, we haven't had radical liberals. We haven't had radical conservatives on either side. And you don't have to go back all that far to people like Warren Knowles, you know, who was a Republican who worked both sides of the aisle. You know, people like Pat Lucey, you know, a Democrat, worked both sides of the aisle. So there has been, I think, for more of our history, a tradition of not agreement by any means, but at least the basic consensus about moving forward on the basis of the greater good for the entire state of Wisconsin.
You knew Frank Zeidler as well as anybody in this city knew him, probably as well as anybody has known him. It's hard to imagine what Frank Zeidler, and I would have called him, believe me, to be on the air, what he would have said. So you can speak through for him.
I think, in my opinion, you know, Scott Walker is kind of the anti-Zeidler, and I think of Frank as certainly the epitome of what it meant to be a citizen, you know, someone who believed firmly in the Commonwealth and acted accordingly all his life.
John Gerda is our guest. We're going to welcome phone calls. He's a Milwaukee historian. If you have a chance, you can read the article perhaps while we're talking, or many of you, I'm sure, have already read it. It's in the Sunday, March 6, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, in which he expresses deep concern, really, about the future of this state. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address, if you would like to use that, is talk@WPR.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now for John Gerda. Betsy in River Falls, our first caller. Hi, Betsy.
Hi. First of all, thank you both for this wonderful program. Secondly, I remember the 60s because I was born in the 40s. And three Warren Knowles is buried a mile from my house, and I go talk to him often.
What do you say?
Well, I say hello and how fun it was that he came to my grandmother's birthday and walked around going, I'm the governor, when he wasn't. And we said, yes, Mr. Knowles, you certainly were the governor.
Oh, Betsy, it's a great story.
It was wonderful. But I went to a meeting at the River Falls Public Library to sign petitions to recall Sheila Harsdorf, and the chief of police showed up, and I thought, whoa, this is just like being in the 60s. My name's going to be taken again. And he was on our side because the non-union members of the chief of the police and fire department are not exempt from the collective bargaining. They won't be allowed to bargain. And he was there because he wanted to make note of the fact that it doesn't cover all the police and fire department, just the union members. And he's not a union member, and so it was going to affect his job. And it was kind of fun to have the police on our side for once.
I think that's been true of Madison as well. Some of the grizzled veterans, you know, who can recall back in the 60s, you know, were looking at the people in uniform, and there was a sense of common interest, you know, which was not the case many years ago and certainly is today. I'm sure you say when you stop by Warren Knowles' grave, thanks for the land, because he has been, you know, certainly the Knowles Stewardship Fund has been critical in preserving so much of Wisconsin's great open space.
Thank you very, very much.
Okay,
thanks for the call.
Is it true that Warren Knowles extended collective bargaining to public employees? Did it happen under that administration?
59? I don't know the dates, Kathleen, but it's 59 is when it happened. That's right around his year.
That was his time then.
Yeah.
Betsy, thanks very much for the call. Let's go next to Al in Madison. Hi, Al.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Like the weather, the results are caused by many, many factors, and I'll isolate just one. I was involved in working with low-income households for about 30 years, and from the 1980s and on, just take white male high school dropouts and high school graduates. Their real and inflation-adjusted wages have been dropping steadily, and the grand Republican strategy in the North to exploit the suffering of those folks against the public workers whose wages look pretty good now that their counterparts have dropped so badly with jobs going overseas. The Republican corporate-driven strategy coming out of the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C., is to divide and conquer, get anger among those folks to vote against the Democrats, vote against the teachers, just like the grand strategy in the South in the 60s and 70s was to exploit race to get low-income white males to vote against Democrats. Democrats would put in programs that would help them, but they vote their feelings and vote against themselves by voting in a lot of Republicans on the race issue. It's a ugly but rather effective strategy, but Walker almost succeeded, except for the brave 14 Democratic senators who bolted. And had they not done that, this would be over and done for 2 years, because wouldn't be much people could do to undo it, demonstrations or not.
Thanks, Al, for the call, John.
I think what's happened, I think certainly that is going on, the kind of divide and conquer strategy, but what you've got going on there is you have a dogmatic, inflexible governor who has created an equal and opposite force. And certainly the sleeping giant has awakened. And you see, you know, in Madison, just look at the signs from boilermakers and steelworkers as well as public employees. No, this is a more united front than I think it probably has been in our time.
What does it say, though, John, about the Democrats and their lack of organization or their lack of vision that, A, they lost the legislature and the governor's office here in the state, and, B, that all they could do, and it has kept the conversation going, but all they could do is leave the state? Are they kind of impotent?
there have not been the leadership certainly has not been outstanding. And you've got, you know, the last election, I mean, Tom Barrett was certainly a centrist candidate that I'll bet you if people could vote again, you know, Tom Barrett may well be our governor. But there is kind of the state party and the city party. You know, there tends to be, you know, something of a lack of statewide coordination. But no single figure has kind of stepped forward to lead the charge. So it's been, for many years, kind of a fractious coalition anyway, which would be sort of the culture of democracy. But at the same time, you know, they are showing a good deal of solidarity at the very least.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the fact that this was kind of dropped on us. People have said that had they known what the agenda was going to be, maybe they would have voted because people didn't really turn out in the nut kinds of numbers that they did to make a different kind of outcome. Do you think that people knew deep down what was happening? Were you surprised by this budget repair bill, by
no,
the budget?
No. People in Milwaukee were not surprised.
Really?
People outstate may have been.
Because he was county executive?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we had 8 years, you know, of I sat for a year or so on the County Parks Advisory Commission. And the numbers were ominous. You know, there has been something like $300 million of deferred maintenance that's just piled up, you know, for lack of reinvestment. And they won a gold medal award for management, but not for maintenance. You know, this is something that going forward is in severe danger. So I think the warning signals, if anybody in Milwaukee was paying attention, you know, were that given a larger stage, the same thing would happen on a larger scale, and certainly has. I was surprised by the speed, you know, with which he moved. there were no trial balloons, and this was kind of just, you know, pedal to the metal from the very beginning. But in terms of the agenda, the proposals, no, I don't think there was anything especially revolutionary, different in terms of being different from what he'd done earlier.
So let's look at young people. You have young people in your family, and I do as well. Did they not become politically active? Did they lose all their enthusiasm after the Obama race? What happened?
Oh, boy, a lot of things. It's you certainly had a number of things going on. No, one was that you have people on the left, you know, the health care bill, you know, that was not handled extraordinarily well. You know, if you have a figure like Nancy Pelosi, who is polarizing in her own right, you know, saying we have to pass this bill to find out what's in it, I mean, that's like putting gasoline on a fire. You know, so you had resentment of the Republicans, and the Tea Party kind of rises from that resentment. So you have the passion kind of shifting to that side as Obama and the Democrats are stuck with an intractable economy, all kinds of difficult issues going on in foreign affairs. So there was a sense, I think, kind of a stasis. No, there wasn't a lot of move forward. So frankly, when you look at the election of 08, no, the fervor was messianic. And who can live up to that? So there was, a letdown that was probably inevitable.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, Al, for the call. Mike in South Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hello. I'm a fan of John Gerdes, and I'm calling from the Socialist Utopia Grant Park.
I was there.
Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
I was there cross-country skiing last night.
And I'd like John to talk about the Socialists of Milwaukee. You've alluded to Frank Zeidler and what they accomplished, and I'd also like to hear if they did anything negative. And I'd like you to contrast the ethos of someone like Frank Zeidler and Scott Walker. I think there's a certain meanness to Scott Walker. It goes beyond just ideology. There's something driving that guy that is, I consider, mean-spirited. So could you talk about what the Socialists did in Milwaukee County? Talk about Frank Zeidler and contrast him with our present governor, and I'll listen.
What they did very simply was turn a city that had been, like many American cities, a boss-ridden and thoroughly corrupt municipality into a model of good government. And the real breakthrough was in 1910 when Emil Seidel became our first socialist mayor, and that continued through Dan Hoehn and then Frank Zeidler. So Milwaukee is the only city in the entire United States that not only had socialist mayors, but had them for most of 50 years. So it is an extraordinary historical record here in the Milwaukee area. And what they believed in very simply was what they called public enterprise. And that was using public funds for the public good, the greatest good of the greatest number, especially the workers. And they would invest public funds in public works, public parks, public libraries, public streets, public housing, public ports, public natatoria. You know, so there was a very strong sense that we were all in this together and that we would pool our resources to create a high quality of life for all of us. And I think the obvious retreat and the saddest erosion has been that move from a sense that we are all in it together to a sense that we are all kind of these atomized individuals who are after our own self-interest. And I said in the article that what I think is being invoked here by a lot of the folks in the Tea Party is Ayn Rand, you know, kind of the gospel of pretty much radical selfishness. You know, she called it positivism, but it was pretty much every man or woman for himself or herself, and glorifying individuality. And in this society, in American society, we have always had this tension between the individual and the community. You know, it has never really settled on one side of that spectrum. And we are very clearly on the individual side of that spectrum today. As I said in the article, I'll get mine, you know, has superseded, we'll get ours.
Mm-hmm. We have some very interesting emails. Let's go to a couple of these. Here's one from Bill in Milwaukee. With great deference to our beloved historian, John left out a piece of the referendum that we passed about parks and transit. The sales tax he mentioned, he neglected to mention that we also voted to reduce property taxes by a like amount. Not
That's
a
right.
tax hike, but a swap.
That's right. So it was taking something off the property tax rolls and putting it where it was targeted, you know, again, to the Commonwealth.
Here's another one from Gary Shulman, who's chair of the Frank Zeidler Memorial Lecture Committee. The 2009 Frank Zeidler Memorial Lecture, you were the person who did that, John. You might like to note that the topic this year is, and I'm sure it will be well attended, the future of public employees unions. And the speaker is historian William Jones of UW-Madison, who is writing a book on the subject and was quoted in the New York Times on Sunday.
And who is married to my first cousin once removed.
You're kidding me. Isn't this a small world where everybody's in it for the common good? The event is Tuesday, March 29th at Centennial Hall of the Milwaukee Public Library. Here's an email from John in Madison, who loves you not just because he agrees with you, but he loves your calm and tone of voice, which gives a welcome sense of civility and even serenity to the topic at hand. That's true. It is true. You have that
Boy.
Kind of manner.
Well, serenity seems like a stretch these days.
But you do seem serene, despite it all. And finally, I wonder if the forbidden words progressive taxation can be mentioned before the hour is up. For some reason, it's taboo to mention these words together when it is what we used to do, and it worked just fine.
Mm-hmm. And that was under the Republicans as well as Democrats. So, I mean, think of the brackets that were here in Eisenhower's era compared to what they've become in the more recent years. Yeah, absolutely. And I think in terms of, you know, whether it's serenity or whatever, I think it's important if it is wrong for Walker and the Tea Party to demonize public teachers, public employees, it is just as wrong to demonize Walker and the Tea Party. You know, and I was, you know, in Madison dismayed to see signs comparing him to Hitler or Mubarak. That is just not the case. That is simply not the case. You know, I think we need to, as good as that might feel and as a dramatic public theater it might be, you know, I think it's important to keep this conversation on a level of the issues and civility.
Yeah. I think people feel that they need to be heard on this issue, mm-hmm. that they're running into a brick wall on things, and maybe they're not going to get all that they want, but there's this great need to sit down and let's talk about all of
right.
this.
And I understand the frustration, you know, but you don't it is less constructive to relieve that frustration by blasting, you know, by flame throwing, you know, which is kind of much of what has gone on the other side, you know. So I remember in high school, it was there were some of the wilder kids who would, you know, do what they call trading licks. You know, I hit you, you hit me, and we'll see who can take the hit the best. So, I mean, where does that get you? You know, I guess is the
Nowhere.
Question.
Nowhere. Right. Daryl from Couderay is next. Hi, Daryl.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi,
and Daryl. John.
Good morning.
I have what I feel is an important observation on this. I realize that what is happening in Madison is a needed protest, and I'm glad to see the people turning out. And I believe when all is said and done, it's about collective bargaining rights and other concerns regarding our budget. But that is about money in the final analysis. So I don't say this lightly, but for the last 9 years, we have been paying for two wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, where our military doesn't even count those that our troops have killed. But as soon as Scott Walker tries to put hands in Wisconsin citizens' pockets, the citizens take to the streets in Madison. I find this very ironic and sad, for it clearly expresses the American mindset. Because we pay for those wars, but don't say much about that for 9 years now. But we are very concerned about our jobs.
John.
That's a legitimate point. It's a legitimate point. And certainly it's, you know, when self-interest is invoked, and I think it's, for a lot of people, it is self-interest. It's also a matter of principle. You know, I think the whole notion that workers have a right to participate in the conditions of their employment and wages is sacred in this country. And it's not just a pocketbook issue. It is an issue of principle as well. But I do agree, you know, that the matters of larger principle involving, you know, our involvement in foreign conflicts have been overlooked and swept aside, you know, in the recent years.
Thanks, Gerald, for the call. Mike in West Dallas. Hi.
Good morning.
Hi.
I guess I'd like to make a comment that, you know, this is 30 or 40 years of brilliant Republican strategy. I think it's diabolical, but it's still brilliant. What's happened over the past years, starting with probably Goldwater, but more with Reagan? When Reagan eliminated the Fairness Doctrine, he opened up the door for what I call the Republican message machine, the talk radio heads who claim to be entertainment, but what they do is basically rally the troops. In 96, when there was a Telecommunications Act that was under Clinton that was signed, essentially gave all the broadcasting rights to large groups like Clear Channel and some of the conservative dollars. But my point probably is more along the lines of psychology. The Republicans have been building a mantra based on what I call the reptilian brain, fear and uncertainty. And while the Democrats are trying to have rational, upper-level thinking discussions, there is no discussion because the Republican strategy is to basically make people fear and afraid of anything that the Democrats propose. So
let's get a response, John.
Well, I think I use the word reptilian to describe more demeanor in the story. I think, you know, neither side is Simon Pure. You know, there certainly have been no brickbats thrown from the Democratic side as well. And the Fairness Doctrine is probably more your territory, Kathleen.
I think we need to return to the Fairness Doctrine. There is my thought on it. I've always felt that way. I've looked at other stations I've worked for and how they have changed so completely, and I'm still functioning in that era. I think, how can you do this?
Right.
How can you do this?
And some of the ads, you know, certainly the recent crop in the last couple of weeks, you know, that were just saturation for a few days there.
Unbelievable,
incredible.
Isn't it?
And talk about no holds barred. No, this was not just bending the truth, but just breaking it. But I think you were asking about the election before. You know how the Democrats lost, the Republicans were swept in, and you have, you know, almost like carpet bombing in the media. And the message, I recall the one that stood out to me was more jobs, less taxes. You know, what's not to like? And I compared that to telling a six-year-old you can have no less broccoli and more ice cream. You certainly lose nuance, let's put it that way.
Exactly.
The other thing that is troublesome to me, and it's troublesome for Democrats as well as for Republicans, is, and we've talked about this for so many years, John, but the fact that David Koch could get through, it wasn't the real David Koch, of course, and have this conversation with Scott Walker, I find really troublesome, just as I find insurance companies essentially writing a health care reform bill that will be satisfactory for their profits. There's something way off with this money in politics, and why doesn't this is my own personal thing, why doesn't anybody do anything about it?
You certainly cannot screen the governor's calls for him.
Right.
And to be honest, you know, if Barack Obama was, you know, had reason to believe that a major donor was calling.
I know, it's terrible.
He would take that call, sure.
Of course. Well, that's not right. What about us?
We should have access, too.
I agree.
He only has so many hours.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's go next to Rick is calling us from Port Washington. Hi, Rick.
Yes, I'd like to reinforce the speaker's comment about Nancy Pelosi and Barack Obama and their ramming through of the health care bill that basically, I don't want to say lit the fuse, but it certainly threw more gas on the fire of the anti-big government constituency out there. And that even though it's a local issue in Wisconsin, it's sort of like overshadowed by the fact that there are some big government proposals that got pushed through as the health care bill that did set people off. I'd like to get that out again as a comment.
All right. John?
No, I agree. No, it's a point I've made as well. And it's, again, no equal and opposite reactions. At least if the reception was they were shut out of the process, and no, you get a reaction in kind. And no, that was... And some things, you look on the national level, healthcare was not sold well. On the state level, high-speed rail was not sold well. No, this was something that might well have gone on had it been not castigated as a choo-choo to Madison.
Mm-hmm.
No, this was part of a regional rail system, you know, linking Chicago with Minneapolis and the West Coast. And in the message from the Doyle administration, that was never communicated, you know. So, you know, that tended to be a relatively easy target.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call. John Gerda, Milwaukee historian, is our guest this hour, and we're referencing the piece that he wrote on demon government that was in the Crossroads section of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel this past Sunday. Our phone number, we have time for a couple more phone calls, is 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. The second hour of the program, we're going to go beyond the state of Wisconsin and look at a number of cities. Vallejo in California, just north of San Francisco, is one of them, looking at what could be the latest version of economic disaster. It filed for bankruptcy in 2008, and there are national figures who are saying that cities and perhaps even some states should file for bankruptcy. Our guest is the author of the piece that was the Sunday New York Times magazine section, so that should be a good hour.
Maybe I'll stay.
you can ask questions too.
Sure.
Yeah, what the heck? You do the show with me. Why not? More phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls. We go next to Matt from Viroqua. Hi, Matt.
Hi, John. It was a great piece. I really enjoyed it. I know you've also written about family-scale farming in this state. And I'm just wondering, I've lived in Wisconsin for 10 years now, and I've seen a really dramatic split in the state, even more so than in other states where I've lived, between the urban and the rural. And I'm just wondering, I think urban workers and the working-class people have a lot of common interests with family-scale farmers. And even under the Democrats, we've been under corporate attack in the family-scale farm. And I'm wondering if this is going to be a potential to have some lasting coalitions built between those two groups of people, outstate and in urban areas.
Well, you'd certainly hope so. And that's the old model, the farmer labor progressive, you know, which is FLPs in Minnesota and Wisconsin had a version of that as well. Actually, you're in Viroqua. My mother's from Coon Valley. Was raised on a dairy farm, no, just down 14 from you. And all my cousins went to Westby High School. So I've always felt myself to be kind of bi-coastal. was raised here on the Lake Michigan shore, but my mom's whole side of the family's from around the Mississippi. And I would certainly hope that there could be more of a sense of common interest between rural and urban workers especially. You know, one thing that kind of militates against that is sort of the decline in the number of family scale farms and the dramatic growth of these CAFOs, you know, these factory farms, you know, throughout the state. We were up biking in Manitowoc County this summer, and I think they had 6,000 cows. 6,000 cows.
How did you learn that?
on a carousel being milked 24/7. And there you have kind of an urban model moving the other way, where you have industrial scale production out in the country, and just this incredible, you had the manure trucks going out and the feed trucks coming in, inputs and outputs, so it was dramatic. And to the extent that that has an impact in the future of farming in Wisconsin, that certainly is that makes it perhaps less possible, except maybe you get back to a sort of an industrial union model, where you have all those hundreds of workers and some of those CAFOs, being ripe for organizing as well.
Thanks, Matt, for the call. Carol from Muscadet, hi.
Hi, thank you. I wish to reference this larger historical context that we keep ignoring in our discussions, and it's frustrating to me, but there's the relentless strategies of the neoconservatives to starve the beast of government, and this has been going on for years in their own words. That's what they say, the neoconservative. The really toxic thing that has happened here is that the Tea Party, the libertarians, and the neoconservatives have cut kind of a deal to meet this end of starving the beast, destroying government. And, that will fall out later historically. But right now, the Tea Party, which people think is grassroots, it's not really grassroots at all. It's funded largely by the Koch brothers. And it was their father who started the John Birch Society, was one of the founders of the John Birch Society. This goes way back. And so this eruption in Wisconsin is not just a spontaneous, spurious thing. It is part of that strategy, and we had a vulnerable tool of a governor who was willing to play this tune for these people, and he's doing everything he can without understanding, I don't think, what he's doing.
John?
I don't doubt that Scott Walker actually believes the principles he's espousing. I will give him the credit of not considering him a tool of special interests. And I would also say that despite the funny of the Koch brothers, the Tea Party movement does have a very impressive grassroots dimension. There are people on the the lower, certainly not in the influence making section of society who very much take that message to heart. And I think it's again this durable tension between individual and community, and we have moved away from a sense of government as all of us together, to a sense of government as the other, as this alien, predatory force that is somehow interfering with how we live our lives. So kind of, and I think that's up to us. That's up to the people of Wisconsin and this country to restore that sense of the common good and the commonwealth. And I see that in the movement that has taken form in recent weeks, but it has some very solid historical foundations, and I think we need to return to those.
I'm sorry, Sherry, it can only be about 30 seconds, but go ahead. Delafield, hi.
Hi. Just wanted to make the comparison that John did to Prohibition. I'm wondering about the comparison with McCarthyism of the 1950s. It reminded me of him waving his empty folder around until somebody, Edward R. Murrow, had the guts to stand up to him and ask him if he had no decency.
All right, we have to stop there. 10 seconds. Can you do it? Yes.
I don't think it's McCarthyism. I don't think it's a witch hunt. I think it is more an ideological war.
Oh, very good. Less than 10 seconds. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you. Interesting hour. Great article. What are you writing about this week? Do you have...
Next month, I think I may do something on other points of polarization in Wisconsin's history.
All right. Good, good. I'm glad to hear that. John Gerda, Milwaukee historian. Please look at his piece in Sunday's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It's well worth reading, even if you don't agree with what he has to say. He's a great writer, and it's a very thoughtful piece. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the hour and to Chrissy for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We will... return with another hour of conversation following the news. Oh, I'm sorry. I have another minute. Chrissy is telling me. I have another minute. Okay, well, I'll talk some more then. I'll tell you that. How did I mess that up when we had so many phone calls? Tomorrow, I mentioned that we... I think we're doing public schools tomorrow at 9 o'clock, aren't we, Chrissy? Because there's so much concern about what's going to happen with public schools. We're doing an hour on that. And the second hour of our program, Joyce Carol Oates will join us. She has written about the loss of her husband. She was married to for well over 40 years, and he died about 3 years ago. A Widow's Story is the name of her book, so she will be joining us tomorrow during our 10 o'clock hour. I'm very sorry, everybody. I just didn't read the time right, which is a bad thing to do on radio. Got to get that time right. I'll do better. This is the Ideas Network.